Don't follow inferior principles. Don't live heedlessly. Don't entertain false views. Don't be one who, by following inferior principles, keeps the world going. Get up. Don't be heedless. Live practicing the Dhamma which is good conduct. One who lives practicing the Dhamma dwells happily both in this world and the other world. Live practicing the Dhamma. Do not live behaving badly. One who lives practicing the Dhamma dwells happily both in this world and the other world. So this is the Buddha in the Dhammapada, and the phrase practicing the Dharma, living practicing the Dharma, is Dhammachari. Dhammachari. So that's one of our sort of root texts, if you like, for the name of our ordination. A Dhammachari. Sorry? It's in the section on the world. So it's chapter 13, page 62 in Bhante's translation. But it's very strong, isn't it? Very, very strong. The first verse to do with not living heedlessly, living, in other words, with full vigilant awareness, not entertaining false views, not behaving badly. If you do that, you just keep the world going. You keep this very, very sad, increasingly sort of hate-filled, divided world going. Instead, get up, be heedful, be full of awareness, live practicing the Dharma, which is good conduct, sucharita, living well, living according to the principles of the Dharma. A Dhammachari, one who practices, who lives the Dharma, is happy both in this world and the world beyond, now and in the future, whether you conceive of the future as later on in this life or further lives on into the future. Very, very powerful way of speaking, and I rather like that because it's making it clear that the Dhammachari's life is a really alert, wakeful life. And you really are doing something with it. So I just wanted to root ourselves in the Buddha's teaching. Perhaps if, all of us Dhammacharis and Dhammacharinis, perhaps we should have that above our mirrors or something, in our bathrooms, and we read it every morning. That might be help. Probably forget to read it though. I'm sure we'd remember to read it, but you know what I mean. Very easy to get into bad habits. So you've all asked to be ordained. You've all, unless you're already order members, and those who are order members, at one time you did ask to be ordained. You've requested it. I've read many letters from people requesting ordination. I've also sat with people when they've asked for ordination, and it's a very, very moving, very touching experience to read people's ordination request letters, to actually hear them asking, because the way they found the Dharma, in their life, very often it's come out of quite a bit of unsatisfactoriness, even quite a bit of pain. Sometimes it's a sense of vision and inspiration. They've really seen something. Sometimes the two go together, but always the request, I don't think I can think of any exception to this. The request is very, very heartfelt, deeply meant, and quite a big step. I mean, very often in ordination request letters, the person is, it's almost like, how do they put it sometimes? I hope you will allow me to enter into the ordination training or something like that. Almost as if they're saying, I mean, am I really good enough to do that? There's a kind of humility in the request, which again is very, very touching, and makes me realise, and makes us all realise on the ordination team, that we need to treat you all with very great care and take your request very, very seriously. Not to sort of, as it were, play around with them, play fast and loose with them in asking for ordination. You're definitely taking out, taking a step out into a particular sort of space. And obviously we respond. We respond, you know, not just formally with our letters and ordination training packs and things like that, but obviously in all of these going for refuge retreats. I mean, Padmaloka itself is a response to your request for ordination. Most of our retreats are for men who've asked for ordination, and we have other retreats as well. So there's a big response, if you like, coming from the order to your requests here and, of course, in your local centre. So I think it's worth, you know, pondering repeatedly your own request, you know, for ordination, for the Dharmachari ordination. There's great significance in that. And I think sometimes people can lose touch with it in their ordination training. They can lose connection with their original impetus, what made them, what prompted them to want to live this life. They can get a bit confused, maybe a bit caught up with, you know, perhaps communication difficulties within the Sangha or with the sort of details of things and, or even what sort of unfolding in their own lives. So it's really important to remember why you asked. Really reflect on that. Remember that beginner's mind, if you like, that, you know, brought you here, that brought you to this place, that brought you to this training for ordination. I mean, very often that can go out of focus. We can get distracted by all sorts of other things in life. At a certain point, you decided that the most important thing you could possibly do was to ask for ordination into the Triratna Buddhist Order. Ask for Dharmachari ordination and really get down to a serious Dharma life. At some point, you had that experience, you had that feeling, you had that mood. Sometimes we can even wonder, I think, even doubt whether we even had that. We can doubt that it was a genuine feeling, or was it just, I don't know, a New Year's resolution or something like that after the binge the night before. That's a joke. You know what I mean? But we can doubt that initial impetus. One of the things that I've often reflected on, the gift from my spiritual friends, from my Kalyana Mitras, from Buddhadasa and Visantra, Lokamitra, Subhuti, others, and from Sangharakshita himself, preeminently, was the fact that when I asked for ordination, I was taken seriously. And I asked when I was a very young man, you know, a youth, a callow youth, in the midst of adolescence. I was, 17 when I asked for ordination, 17 or 18. And the thing was, I was taken seriously, deeply seriously. Sangharakshita especially was concerned to tell me that I didn't have to kind of, you know, get caught up in the world and all the complexities of that, because most of the people in our movement were older than me and, you know, and in some ways were a bit scarred by all that. They weren't that much older, but he was making it very, very clear, you don't have to do that. Probably knowing full well that I'd probably do it within the order or the movement, but that's another thing, because I wasn't asking to be a monk. But that sense of being taken really seriously, my aspiration being taken completely seriously, I didn't realise it at the time, but looking back, that's an enormous gift. That's an enormous gift. In fact, Sangharakshita took me more seriously than I took myself, I realise, in hindsight. You know, he had much more of a sense of the weight and the importance of what I was doing than I did, which is quite a thing again. So I've never forgotten that. So it's very important to take yourself seriously and be around spiritual friends who take you seriously. This is one of the great things about Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendships, spiritual community, Spiritual friends will take your Dharma life seriously. They will take your aspiration seriously. Or they should be, if they're worth the name, spiritual friend, order member, whatever. They take you seriously. Worldly friends won't. They might be very good to you, they might like you, but they won't take you seriously. That's what a worldly friend is. They won't take your aspiration seriously. Might be very, very good people, might be very, very helpful. But to be really seen, you know, for your aspiration to follow the Dhammacharya, the Dharma life, to be really seen, that is probably one of the greatest gifts you could give anybody. So we take you very seriously. We take your request completely seriously. Perhaps even sometimes more seriously than you take it yourself. It's one of the reasons why these Going for Refuge retreats are, they will be full on. If you're new to it, just to warn you that we don't sort of treat any of you as beginners. You're going to get the full on Dharma of an order member when you come on these retreats. It's really important, I think, that everybody understands this. We're not going to dilute it down. And I know sometimes in the past that some people have come on Going for Refuge retreats and they've found it very challenging, very demanding. And they felt that they've had to kind of do a bit more work at home, if you like, or at their centre, before being able to really make use of these retreats, particularly in the form of Dharma study and really getting a meditation practice sorted out, that kind of thing. But this is important. You've asked to enter the order. You've asked for your Dharmacharya to be fully seen. So, you know, we're going to show it to you in its as fully as we possibly can. So let's just stay with this business of asking, requesting. It's a very, very important practice in Buddhism experience. I mean, it's there in the puja, isn't it? You know, the sixth stage of the puja, there is entreaty and supplication, where we're entreating the Buddhas to teach, to make shine the lamp of the Dharma for those wandering in the suffering of delusion. We ask as well the conquerors, the jinnas who are about to enter Parinirvana to stay. We want those with real Dharma quality, Dharma presence, insight, wisdom to actually be there. We entreat them. And then after that there's the Heart Sutra, or a reading, and then the Heart Sutra. Some ways, from a certain point of view, this is the most important point in the puja. It's all been leading up to this moment of entreating and supplicating so that you can really hear and listen to the Dharma, so the Dharma can go really deeply into your consciousness. And of course, it reflects things from the life of the Buddha, stories from the life of the Buddha, Brahma's request. You know, the Buddha, his sense of the transcendence of the Dharma was such that he felt that he couldn't teach. He couldn't make it known. People would just not see it until he was asked to look again. And if you like, even an enlightened being needs to know that people want what he's got to teach. Compassion isn't a free gift. Compassion isn't like you know, the Buddha's compassion isn't sort of, well, he's not a saviour. He can't just sort of take you, whether you want to or not, into Nirvana. That's just not possible. The Buddha needs to know. The Buddha's compassion is such that he needs to know. He needs to sense that you are serious, that we are serious, that there's something in us that's resonating with his enlightenment. Plenty of stories in the Pali Canon where the Buddha's talking to people and they ignore him or abuse him. They don't all open their Dharma eye and enter the stream to enlightenment. So entreaty is really important. Asking, really wanting. Not in a sort of neurotic way, which is very important as well. I mean, you can get sometimes people sort of, you know, kind of wanting ordination as a thing, almost like promotion or something like that, or thinking that it's something that's going to sort of save them in some way. Doesn't work like that. But wanting it in the sense of really wanting to do what's necessary to make the transformation in order that you can be ordained. Being as receptive, alertly receptive and responsive as possible to the Dharma that's being communicated to you. Being as alert and as engaged as possible with what order members, especially your spiritual friends, are actually communicating about the Dharma, even sometimes about you. And being sensitive, if you like, to yourself, sensitive to what you really need to do to change yourself in order to be ordained. So there is this asking, this entreaty, this responsiveness, this dharmic responsiveness, the word receptive, unfortunately, has kind of connotations of something rather passive. If it is receptive, it's a very alert receptivity. It's something really tuned up, you know, to what needs to happen, to what we need to do. So asking is of very great importance. Asking and entreating and being open to what comes back and getting into real dialogue with spiritual friends, with the order members engaged with your training, with your emerging Dharma life, really being in lively dialogue with them. There's a phrase of Bhante's, which I'll probably go into a bit tomorrow, in which he describes what communication is in the spiritual community. He describes it as a vital mutual responsiveness, a vital mutual responsiveness, a common exploration of the Dharma world in complete honesty and harmony. So you want that in your ordination training. Your request is really a quest to enter into that vital mutual responsiveness with order members, with dharmacharis. Now the request for ordination, the asking, the entreaty, is formalised in the ordination ceremony. I want to say a little bit about the ordination ceremony, perhaps not too much, don't want to give too much away. But some of you, I think, have probably been at public ordination ceremonies, and I think you can even hear one on the internet these days. I think there's an early one that Bhante did. There are two aspects to the ordination, private and public. In the private ordination ceremony, you go alone to your private preceptor. Your private preceptor is the person who witnesses directly, who sees and testifies to the fact that you are effectively going for refuge, you are actually living the Dharmacharya, the Dharma life. He sees that in you individually. He doesn't just see it, but sees that it's true. It's actually happening. So the private ordination, the symbolism of that is related in a sense to this asking, to this requesting. Because the symbolism of the private ordination is that you are willing to go it alone if necessary. You're willing to step out on your own to live the Dharmacharya, to live the Dharma life. When Sangharakshita used to do ordinations on the nights, they were usually at night, private ordinations, and he'd be leading a metta bhavana for everybody, and he'd give a little talk beforehand before getting up to go off to the specially prepared shrine room, the private shrine room, which people one by one would come to him to receive the private ordination. He'd always say, never tired of saying it, that even if the symbolism of the private ordination, even if nobody else was going for refuge, even if nobody else was following the Dharmachari, you still would. You'd still want to do it. It's really coming from you. That is a very, very strong statement. Well worth pondering for all of us. This willingness to go it alone if necessary. It's not, sometimes this can be used, has been used as a sort of way of justifying individualism, or even people thinking that, that in some way the private ordination ceremony is sort of superior to the public ordination. I'm doing it on my own. It's not meant in that way. It's not meant in that way at all. The way in which it's meant that you would be willing to create spiritual community if nobody else was. You would be willing to uphold the values of the Dharma if nobody else was. You would be willing to get up, in the verse of the Dhammapada, to get up and really live the Dharma life, even though the world is pushing against you. That is a very difficult thing to do. And it, I think even, you know, certainly us in the order, just because we've undergone a private ordination, we shouldn't assume that we've got this down, you know, that we've sussed this out. It's a tremendously powerful point that, that Bhante is making. We're willing to go it alone. And I think within that, there is an element of going forth. There's an element of going forth. There's an aspect of going forth in our ordination ceremony. Doesn't necessarily mean we're going to go off and become a monk and so on and so forth. But going forth in the sense that you're not going to be guided or dictated to by the sort of group norms, the group currents that are around you, the pressures that are exerted, you know, from the world around you, from family, from friends, from colleagues and so on. You're going to be taking your values, you're going to be taking your values, you're going to be taking your actions from your Dharmacharya. And that might well mean, the symbolism of this, willing it to go it alone, might well mean that you are going to have to change and transform your different relationships. There's a point that Subhuti said when he was sitting here giving his talks on our system of practice. He's saying it's really important, you know, those of you living a Dharma life, all of us living a Dharma life, that whatever context you're in, family, work, all the different relationships, it's clear that this is the life you're living. These are the values that you're following. You're not, in other words, compromising, you know, to the world. You don't have to do that aggressively, you don't have to do that unpleasantly, but this is the life that you are actually living. Sometimes it can come up in relation to things like diet. I mean, one of the things that Sangharakshita is very, very keen on, he believes that the best, or one of the easiest way, the most immediate ways of practicing the first precept is to be a vegetarian, even be a vegan. Well, that might bring you into conflict with family, even friends. But no, you decide to do it. No, this is the tradition I'm following. I follow the non-violent Buddhist tradition. This is the expression of my Dharmacharya. Meditating every day. Well, you might live in a household where people don't want you to do that, or the conditions are very difficult for that. But you do. You get up before everybody else. You meditate so that you can really work on your mind, really fulfill the mind precepts of the 10 precepts. So there's all sorts of practical ways in which going it alone work themselves out. It might even be within the order itself after you're ordained. You might be in a chapter meeting with other order members, all ordained, and suddenly you notice that for some reason or other there's been a kind of collective weirdness is happening. Maybe a group of order members are sort of turning on somebody, or in the meeting, or suddenly they've you know, gone a bit kind of wrong view crazy and suddenly believing in God or something like that. I don't think that's ever happened, but you see what I mean. And you think, no, I'm not going to allow this. We're Dharmacharis. I'm a Dharmachari. And you speak up, even though you might get into a fair bit of conflict. So going it alone has this implication of standing alone, of true individuality. And at times you might have to really live from that, even though it's uncomfortable, difficult, painful. But you can't go back on those values. This is one of the strange things. When you've really connected with going for refuge deeply, when you've really seen it, you feel that, oh, I've just got to make a stand, even though you know it's going to make life is going to be difficult. That's what going forth means. That's what renunciation means. So you're asking from yourself. This is really important. You're asking from something deep within yourself for ordination. You're coming from something deep within yourself. You haven't asked because your friends have asked, or your spouse has asked, or something like that, or because it's the thing to do in your centre. It's coming from you, from deep within you. In the actual ordination itself, and perhaps it's best now to dwell on the public ordination, because in the public ordination, the way Bhante speaks about that, that although you were willing to go it alone, actually you realise you don't need to, because there is this spiritual community. There are all these other dharmacharis and dharmacharinis, all these others who are going for refuge, who you can join with in spiritual community and live the Dharma alongside them, with them, for the benefit of others, for the benefit of the world. But in the public ordination, there's a particular, there's a sequence of events before, if you like, the heart of the ordination happens. You make offerings of flowers and lights and incense. You take them from your preceptor, your public preceptor. And you notice this when people do it. You know, I've seen this as a public preceptor, that the way that people make their offerings, they do it with great reverence and care. And the symbolism here is that you are really opening up. You're really opening up to the occasion. You're really opening up to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. You're opening up to your preceptor. You're opening up to the order. There are some verses of purification, because the Dharmachari's life from a certain point of view can be seen as a deepening purification of body and speech and mind. You know, through all your actions of body, speech and mind, you're purifying and purifying until such point as you realise the ultimate purity of Buddhahood. It's a life of purification, very important for us all to remember that. And then what happens is that you formally request ordination. You usually repeat the verses. You formally request ordination, and you usually repeat the verses in Pali after your public ordination. You say in Pali, I'll do it in English, Bhante, I wish, how does it go? Bhante, I wish to take the three refuges together with the Dharmachari ordination vows. Kindly give them to me, Bhante. Bhante being your preceptor. So this is a very important moment where you ask to be given the refuges and the precepts. And your preceptor will say after that, repeat whatever I say. And you say, yes, Bhante. A very, very interesting moment in the ordination ceremony, that moment. You know, we always say, well, okay, you might have asked for ordination a long time ago, but you have to remind yourself that I really want it now. I really want this. So that's reflected in the ceremony. And you follow your preceptor. You follow your preceptor. He gives you the refuges. He gives you the precepts. So I want to sort of dwell a little bit on what's going on here, just to try and get inside the Dharmachari ordination. A bit later on in the ceremony, towards the end of the ceremony, there are four verses, or a verse with four parts to it. And these are sometimes called the acceptance verses, or even sometimes the ordination vows. And they represent the spirit with which the ordination is given and received. And the first of these verses goes, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. So I want to relate this to the moment when the preceptor gives you the refuges and precepts. It's related to this, with loyalty to my teachers. when the heart, if you like, of the Dharmacharya ordination happens. Let's just dwell on that a bit. So the public preceptor, the private preceptor, witnesses your individual, your private ordination, your individual going for refuge. The public preceptor is receiving you into the order. He's completely satisfied in your training. He's got full confidence in your private preceptor. He's a public preceptor because he has the full confidence of other public preceptors, the preceptors' college, as we call it, and therefore has the full confidence of the order in principle. So it's quite a moment when the public preceptor gives you the refuges and precepts. And one of the things that the public preceptor is will be concerned to know, if not directly, certainly, or one of the things he's relying on, is that our understanding, the understanding of order members, his understanding as a public preceptor of the of going for refuge, coincides with yours, at least to some extent. There's a mutual understanding of the significance of what is happening. A mutual understanding both in terms of clarity of thought, but also the very feeling and atmosphere of what's going on. That he's seeing that what you are doing is what he is doing. What he is doing, you're seeing what he is doing is what you are doing. This is really important. Sangharakshita calls this, there's a witnessing of going for refuge. A witnessing of going for refuge. You want to be ordained because you relate to going for refuge. You see the going for refuge in us. You like it, if you like. Well, not just you like it. You have a sense of its value, that this is the way to live. This Dharmacharya is the way to live. And what order members see in you, and this is really brought to its conclusion in the public ordination ceremony, public preceptor saying, yes, you are doing that, so I can receive you into the order. So I want to sort of dwell a little bit on this common understanding of the nature of going for refuge, the nature of the Dharmacharya, this common understanding really of the nature of ordination. We need to get a real sort of feel for that, this mutual understanding. I think one thing that we really need to appreciate, and I don't think it is appreciated even sometimes within the order, that ordination, Dharmacharya ordination, is absolutely unique in the Buddhist world. It's unique in the Buddhist world. Our ordination comes from a vision of the Dharma, an understanding of the Dharma that is unique. There's lots of ordinations throughout the Buddhist world, different kinds of bhikshu ordination, different ordination lineages, different kind of levels of things. The Dharmacharya ordination is unique. And it comes from a teacher. It comes from Sangharakshita. Bhante Urgyen Sangharakshita has seen the particular significance of this ordination, has in a sense, how can I say, I don't want to use the word invented, I've used it now, has devised, has seen, has evolved, if you like, this particular ordination out of his particular vision of the Dharma. And the first thing to be said about that is that it's all to do with his insight into the centrality of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. We use this phrase so much, so regularly, it's so important, it can lose its meaning. It gets reduced to GFR, GFR groups, GFR mitras, my GFR, your GFR, which is unfortunate. It's unfortunate because might be a useful shorthand, but perhaps people don't really know why that language is used. why that language of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is used. It's a very important book, a number of important books, The History of My Going for Refuge. This is an absolute must read. And if you really want to know the significance of ordination into the Triratna Buddhist Order, you have to read this. This is Sangharakshita plotting his discovery from a very young age, the centrality of going for refuge. It's his exploration. You won't find this, you know, approach to things in any other Buddhist tradition. It's not that going for refuge isn't mentioned. It's not that it's unimportant necessarily, although it can be just relegated to a very, very basic Buddhist practice. It's more or less meaningless in some Buddhist countries. But this is showing how central going for refuge is. Another important book is The Ten Pillars of Buddhism, which again insists on the centrality of going for refuge, but also talks about our particular precepts, our ten precepts. We're the only order that I know of that make the ten precepts our pratimoksha, our fundamental code of ethics. And Sangharakshita explores that. This might seem sort of unimportant to you, but actually it's really important. You might think, yeah, but where's the real practical value? If you don't know the vision of ordination in our tradition, you can't practice the Dharmacharya properly. You really need to know its full significance. So Sangharakshita, one of the things he does with this realization of the centrality of going for refuge is to go back. One of the number of sort of, in a way, converging concerns, I think, of Sangharakshita from a very young age. One very early concern was that this belief in the fundamental transcendental unity of Buddhism. And if you look at the Buddhist world, you see such a range of practices, you know, all over, you know, different Asian countries, and even traditions in conflict, and all this sort of thing of the superiority of a particular school over another. You know, they're constantly adding, you know, that this school is the highest, and so on. You know, incredible sort of branding and advertising that goes on, in ancient Buddhist tradition. That was a concern for Sangharakshita. And, you know, very, very early on, when he was 17, he wrote an article called The Unity of Buddhism. He was that concerned about it. He had this sort of intuition. Perhaps it was the effect of reading the Diamond Sutra and Sutra of Hui Neng so young, that there was a sort of fundamental kind of vision, insight, realization of the Buddhas that underlies every single expression of the Dharma. Even if it's in Shin Buddhism that the path is, well, there isn't a path, you rely on the grace of Amitabha, whereas in the Zen tradition you rely on just sitting, etc., or whatever it might be. He has this sense, actually, you've got to sense that underlying unity. Not in a facile way, but something, you know, to really see, you know, directly in your experience. So that's one big theme of his that you see recurring in his writings. But then it becomes, over the years, and perhaps it's to do with him becoming more and more of a teacher and having disciples of his own, beginning to see it's got to be worked out practically. It needs to be worked out practically in behaviour. And one of the things he notices in his studies of the Pali Canon, very, very basic, you know, stories that could have been read and just passed over while you get on to the really hot stuff to do with, you know, Satipatthana and insight and all the rest of it. He notices something. One of the things he notices, and he notices it because of his devotion to the Buddha, his deep feeling for the Buddha, is the effect of the Buddha's communication. The strength of the Buddha's communication. You know, the Buddha will give a teaching to somebody, he'll get into communication with them. Could be any kind of person, you know, a merchant, man, woman, a wanderer, a full, you know, if you like, a full-time religieuse or whatever it might be, a playboy, whatever. And in the course of that communication, something happens. You know, they have, there is that vital mutual responsiveness. It says their dharma eye opens. They see the truth. They see the way things are. They actually experience, if you like, what the phrase in the tradition is, they feel independent of the teacher in the sasana. This is a very interesting phrase, which is misunderstood very often. That the word sasana means something like, it's not just the Buddha's teaching, but the Buddha's teaching as an authority, in the positive sense. That this dharma has a real weight, you know, to them. The teaching has a, it's powerful. It's not something, you know, it's something they, if you like, they have to assent to. It's got a, you know, it's got the force of truth. And independence means that they've internalized it. It's not dependent. Their feeling for the Dharma, their faith in the Dharma, their confidence in the Dharma is not based upon external conditions. And they say things like, they're so amazed at what's happening. They, those wonderful phrases, that if that which was knocked over is now set up straight, it's as if a light is lit in the darkness so that those with eyes can see. It's as if a way is shown to someone who was lost. They say all these things. They've seen the truth. They've entered the stream even. Then they go for refuge. To the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. As long as breath lasts, in every breath, I will go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Very, very powerful. Very, very strong sense of, you know, vowing to always rely upon the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But that expression, that action, is coming out of a realization of the truth. It's coming out of their sense of connecting with the truth. Very often, well, always, there will be some sort of change after that. They'll either go forth and become a wanderer, a wandering follower of the Buddha, or their home life will be completely changed. They will, you know, commit themselves to a whole different course of activities. They will also probably get involved in the work of the Dharma, of spreading the Dharma. So what Sangharakshita sees in those moments, you know, in the earliest tradition, is that going for refuge isn't simply a kind of elementary Buddhist ceremony that if you're a born Buddhist, you just parrot, you know, because that's what you've learnt from childhood. It's coming out of a profound spiritual experience, a spiritual transformation, which involves seeing the truth, involves a going forth, a change, involves you with other people, involves you in spreading the Dharma outwardly. So he goes further. He takes it even further. And here is a very, very radical move. He says that all of the terms that are used in later Buddhist tradition, which describe the transition from mundane to a transcendental path, a commitment from a shift from being involved with the world to being involved with the Dharma life, are all really descriptions of going for refuge. So in the Mahayana, which makes so much of the arising of the bodhicitta, the arising of the bodhicitta being a movement, a realization of that you need to practice the Dharma for the liberation of all life, that is a restatement of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha in altruistic terms. In altruistic terms, in terms of how you are, what you're going to do in relation to bring about the liberation of all life. Going for refuge isn't a sort of step on the way to that. They're the same thing, just looked at from different points of view. There's a going forth, not in the sense that you will necessarily, you know, become a monk or something like that. Your circumstances might not permit that. But there'll be a reorganization of your social life in the light of your going for refuge. There will be an opening of the Dharma eye. There will be a deep seeing into the unconditioned depth of the refuges and so on. This is a very bold and radical vision of Sangharakshita's. It's a bold and radical vision. One of the things he's saying, look, if you are a Buddhist, if you are seriously going for refuge, what you should be looking for is what you have in common with other Buddhists, not what keeps you apart from other Buddhists. You need to see deeply into the Dharma. And, you know, he talks in, where is it, in the history of my going for refuge. He says a Dharmachari is a mere Buddhist. A mere Buddhist. He doesn't mean like that, mere in the sort of, he means a Buddhist only. A Buddhist only, in the same way that the Yogacharins talk about consciousness only. You're only a Buddhist. You're primarily a Buddhist. A Dharma farer. A Dharma practitioner. And you're meeting people on that basis. But it's even bolder than that. It's even more extraordinary than that. Because he says, you know, he has this bold statement that our ordination is neither monk nor lay. Neither monk nor lay. This is really bold. Again, you might not really appreciate the sort of full force of this, because in the Indian tradition, you know, we're not aware of what it's like in the Buddhist East, where there's a very, very strong distinction between the monks and the laity. Even that the monks are the full-time, first-class, eminent Buddhists, and the laity, you know, are definitely the second-class Buddhists. The monks are really living it, the lay people aren't. Even if, technically, the lay person might be more of a serious practitioner than the monk, that is possible. In terms of social status, the monk is superior, the lay inferior. The monk is the real Buddhist, the lay person is, you know, not the real Buddhist. Well, Sangharakshita is cutting through that, saying if going for refuge is central, it blows away the distinction between monk and lay. It takes that away. Originally, our ordinations were the old Upasaka ordination. When I became was ordained, I was called Upasaka, Padmavajra. But one of the things, but you know, the way us Upasakas were living, certainly in those days, and well, we were living kind of almost like monks, even though we might not have been formally celibate. You know, we were living full-time, you know, Dharma lives, you know, meditating, going on retreats, working for the Dharma, working very hard for the Dharma. And when we started things in India, when we started to have ordinations in India, one of the things that started to happen, some of the things that we started to notice, we were known as Upasakas out there. We had to say that we were 10 precept Upasakas. Dasa Sila Upasakas, because all Buddhists in the new Buddhist community in India regarded themselves as Upasakas, but it was quite obvious that us order members were doing so much more for the Dharma, including more work for the Dharma than most of the monks that we came across. So this was a very, very strange situation. But so at a meeting in 1982 in New Bombay, in India, Sangharakshita suggested that it was time for a change, that from now on we wouldn't use the word Upasaka to describe our ordination, we would use the word Dharmachari to describe our ordination, to make it clear that we were no longer part of the kind of Buddhist ecclesiastical framework. What we do is live the Dharmacharya, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, making our reliance on the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So that's just a bit on the nature of our ordination ceremony. A bit earlier I mentioned this phrase, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. And Sangharakshita has also defined the order, the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, as the community of his disciples and the disciples of his disciples. And I know some people are a bit uncomfortable with this word disciple. They wonder if Sangharakshita has become a sort of, you know, a kind of what's the word, a megalomaniac, you know, wanting to sort of have lots and lots of personal disciples, you know, for his own person and all this sort of thing. Doesn't mean that. Doesn't have that meaning at all. What it means is that you understand the nature of our ordination. You really understand fully and deeply his vision of ordination. He has given us a vision of the Dharma, which is really encapsulated in our ordination ceremony and in this Dharmacharya that he's given us. So to be loyal to your teachers at ordination, to be a disciple of Sangharaksha and a disciple of his disciple, it means really understanding this and really living it and going into it more and more deeply and really discovering what it really means. And of course there is a, you know, there's a path that's laid out. There's this system of spiritual training that Sangharaksha has developed, you know, for us, and which we're still developing and still practicing. But perhaps the thing we need to dwell on more than anything, if we're talking about the Dharmacharya's life, are the 10 precepts that we formally take at ordination, and which you study on the 10 Pillars of Buddhism retreat. So after we go for refuge, after our preceptor, you know, really feeling the meaning of what it means to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, you know, you're really feeling that, really experiencing that, really understanding it and experiencing it, really understanding that you're going to place your reliance no longer on things that will break down, refuges that aren't really refuges, that will fall away, but on refuges that you can really rely on, the Buddha, enlightenment, the enlightened person, the Dharma, the truth, the path, the way, the practices, and the Sangha, you know, the Sangha of spiritual friends, particularly those who have entered the stream and beyond, the Arya Sangha, all those incredible examples of the Dharma life in Buddhist history. After that, you take from your preceptor, the 10 Dharmachari precepts. And these are a complete path in themselves. They're a complete path in themselves. And I can, you know, when you go through that, when you're taking the precepts at ordination, well, sometimes people ask, well, are they vows or are they precepts? Because in the ordination ceremony, the way it's translated into English, Bhante, I wish to take the three refuges together with the Dharmachari ordination vows. Kindly give them to me, Bhante. So people say, well, are they vows or are they precepts? Well, I can assure you, at the time of ordination, it feels as if they are vows. You know, there's such a weight to that ordination ceremony. You really don't want to break those precepts. You don't want to break those training principles. They feel that they have that weight, both in their negative form, what you're going to abstain from, and the positive form. So you're abstaining from killing living beings, from having anything to do with harming living beings, and you're vowing to practice deeds of loving kindness. You're abstaining from taking the not given and taking up all your in all your behaviour, deeds of open-handed generosity. You're abstaining from sexual misconduct, from, you know, using sex in a way that would harm or would cheat or anything like that, and you're developing stillness, simplicity and contentment. You're vowing to be truthful, to abstain from falsehood. You're vowing to abstain from harming people with your speech and practicing kindly, you know, gentle, courteous, loving speech. You're abstaining from frivolous and useless and meaningless speech and vowing to take up meaningful and useful speech. And you're abstaining from all backbiting and gossip and using speech to turn people against each other and vowing to practice speech that is harmonious, that brings people together, that you're going to be a force for harmony. And then you go even deeper with the precepts. You then take the mind precepts. You abstain, you take a precept to abstain from coveting, from craving even. And you commit yourself to the practice of developing peace and tranquility. You abstain from hatred and resentment, and you take up the practice of love and compassion, you know, from all life. And you abstain from false views, from all ignorance and confusion. And you vow to a life of developing wisdom. So that's our precepts. They're the precepts that we take. That describes the Dharmacharya. Goodness, we don't really need anything else, do we? That's what we're taking at ordination. And the thing is, Sangharakshita has given this to us. Yes, it's based on venerable, ancient Buddhist tradition, but he is the first person to make these precepts the fundamental ethical code for all of us. For all of us. Whether we live at home, you know, with our families, and have, as it were, a regular job, or whether we live in retreat centres, whether we're celibate or not, this is our fundamental ethical code. This is what brings us together as Dharmacharyas. And that's how we're loyal to our teachers. That's how we are a disciple. That's what we're loyal to, that we're living this life, and, well, we even revere and have gratitude, you know, for our teachers, particularly for Sangharakshita, for giving this wonderful, you know, gift of the Dharma life. So this is what you're training for. This is what you're practicing for on these Going for Refuge retreats, to prepare for the ordination itself. I mentioned being a force for harmony. I think tomorrow what we'll start looking at a bit more is the second of the four ordination vows, and that is the in harmony with friends and brethren I accept this ordination. But that's probably plenty to be getting on with for today. Thank you.